Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get us. We appreciate that. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, we are going to think that you are a hater. This is our interview for the week, and joining us, we got a man that led 4 different teams to the postseason in Major League Baseball as a manager. He's hanging out at Cape Cod watching some baseball this week. His name is Dusty Baker. Now, Dusty, you are there watching your son play baseball. Do you realize how old it makes some of us feel to think that the little man that was getting scooped up at home played is now out here like playing baseball like a grown-up?
You know, we just brought him here like 3 days ago, and it's been an awesome time out here. You know, so this is a great opportunity for these young guys to show their skills, and they're, you know, playing the best amongst the best. And so, you know, he's one of the few freshmen that's out here, and I'd say they got some pretty good baseball out here, and I see why a lot of people want to come play in this Cape Cod League.
Now, what's life for you like as a baseball father? Like, what is your personality type in the stands for these guys?
Well, really, you know, I go over and sit by myself. Try to sit by myself. It don't last too long. But I try to go over and sit by myself and just watch the game. But, you know, people want to interview you for you know, whatever team you're playing or whatever. And I try to accommodate, you know, most of them. But I'm there to watch baseball. And this is my son's time, you know, of his life. But the hard part is that, man, makes me nervous. You know, I didn't get nervous at all on the field, but I get nervous watching my son play. And I tell you, it's a treat, because this has been a blessing. You know, when the Nationals let me go, I didn't know, you know, I missed a lot of his life. I got to see his freshman year at University of California, Berkeley. So it's been cool. I get to come to Cape Cod here, where I've never been before. And today I'm taking a day trip, you know, from Brewster on Cape Cod all the way to the top up here, you know, Portuguese fishing town, you know, Provincetown. And it reminds me of San Francisco, I mean, a lot. And, you know, I can see myself hanging out here for a little bit.
Now, when you're watching this game, like, how do you balance, like, analyzing it and just simply enjoying it? Because this is your life's work on top of just being a father.
Well, yeah, that's a very good question, man, because I'll tell you, it's what's tough is to not to critique. You know, like, hey, man, you should have backed up here, or you should have been there. And I took a tip from my wife. She goes, kind of wait till he asks. And, you know, I can tell when he wants to talk. And so, you know, I just let him play. And, you know, he's going to be a good player. So right now he's getting stronger. He has a lot of speed, a lot of skill. And, but, you know, I'm always kind of like scouting, you know, who they're playing, or, you know, which players I like on the other team to hone my skills as far as scouting. And you know, that's all managing is, really, is that scouting players that, you know, they may not believe in or you may not believe in, and trying to give them a fair chance to, you know, to be themselves and to shine.
Well, like, from what you can tell, what's it been like for him to be Dusty Baker's son? Because I imagine there's got to be a certain measure of weight that comes when your dad played in the big leagues and managed.
Well, there was one. You know, there was for a while, but, you know, like, he has his own skill set. And, you know, the players accept him. I mean, he's really into being, like, a good teammate and being one of the players. And, you know, like he said, he used to tell me it was hard, you know, for a while there, but now he's making his own way. And I remind him what it was like to be, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. or to be Barry Bonds, or to be, you know, a number of players out there that are now playing. I watched the Futures game, and I saw Charlie Hayes, his son, hit a home run. Keith Bryant, he'd been telling me about him forever, and I saw all the bells come up. And then I saw, you know, I saw Conine's son the other day when I was up in Vancouver scouting. And so, you know, I think it's similar to, like, being an actor's son, where, you know, you're not nervous because you're on the set. You've been on the set your whole life, you know, and the stadiums don't make him nervous. People don't make him nervous. And I think these kids are way ahead of where we were by being, you know, a second generation, you know, baseball player, or third generation, or fourth in some cases. But like I said, it's been a treat to watch him play. So I'm going actually to New York tomorrow to do a NYBC tournament at in Long Island. And I got to get my hands loose, because they got 74 teams, and I'm sure I'm going to be signing a whole bunch of autographs. But, you know, it's nice to drop him off here, leave him here, and, you know, just let him be on his own and let him grow as a man.
Now, did he get into baseball just on his own? Was it something that he just always loved, or was it a matter of just being around it?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, I mean, he was always at the ballpark with me. He was always, I'm not a Facebook guy or any of those kind of, but, you know, he talks to Joey Votto all the time and Jay Bruce and Brandon Phillips. And, you know, the players, you know, seemed to like him because he was always respectable. You know, I didn't force him. You know, I did make it available to him. And, you know, from the time he first picked up, you know, my brush or a comb, he broke it against the corner of the room as a left-handed hitter. And people say, oh, man, did you make him left-handed? No, I didn't make him left-handed. I let him, you know, be what he wanted to be. And, you know, he was always the kid that was sliding on the floor at the airport or sliding in the grocery store. And I'm like, man, you're going to skin your legs up sliding all the time. But, you know, his whole thing, he made up his mind. He was a pretty good basketball player, too, but he made up his mind a long time ago that he wanted to be a baseball player. And so, like I said, I just presented it to him and, you know, made it available to him. And, you know, how many kids grow up at the ballpark, you know? And, man, that's a pretty good life. And I told him, man, my next life, I think I'm going to come back as Darren Baker. Because it's either going to be Darren Baker or be my wife, you know what I mean? Because both of them have a name, you know what I mean?
Hey, man. Like, what is it about baseball for you that just did it, right? You've been around this your entire adult life. Like, what hooked you on baseball?
Well, you know what did for me? You know, my dad was my coach, and he was Barry Bonds. He was Bobby Bonds' his Little League coach. They're from the same town. And, you know, like, I was really a basketball player. That was my favorite sport. When my parents got divorced when I was 18, right before the draft. And, you know, I felt the need to try to help my family, take care of my family, and I forfeited a number of basketball and football scholarships, but it was just something that I prayed on. And, you know, the Lord, you know, told me to, you know, go ahead and sign. It was against my dad's permission because we didn't speak for, you know, for 3 years because, you know, I thought my mean old dad was trying to run my life. You know, that same, I'm 18 now and I'm grown. Same speech that my daughter and my son have told me. And this was coming back to haunt me kind of. But, you know, the fortunate thing in my life was Hank Aaron promised my mom when I signed in Dodger Stadium. And my hero was Tommy Davis. He wore number 12. I wore number 12, still wear number 12. Hank Aaron promised my mother he would take care of me as if I was his son. You know, I didn't stay in the minor league. I was 3.5 years in the minor league, but I was in the big league, you know, in my second year, the September call-up. And Hank took Ralph Gar and myself under his wing, and he, you know, he made us go to church. He made us get up and eat breakfast. He made us, you know, we wanted to hang out late, and he'd tell us to go to bed. And, you know, it was a good thing that I, you know, that I had Hank Aaron, who's like my, you know, like my dad. And I could almost tell him everything. Then I was fortunate enough to have Orlando Cepeda as my uncle. And, you know, your uncle, you can tell them anything. They may not like what you tell them, but, you know, they're not going to run with it and tell anybody. So I was real, real fortunate to have, you know, some guys around that took care of me, you know, from the time I came into baseball.
Well, you know, hearing you talk about that with Hank Aaron, like, was that what made your dad come back around? Because I imagine when Hank Aaron says it's okay, it's like, oh, okay, maybe this isn't so bad.
No, that didn't make my dad come around at all. You know, what made my dad come around is the fact that, you know, I made it to the big leagues. And the choice ended up right. I mean, one of my motivating factors to try to make it was to not have my dad be right. Because back then, it was a major decision to, you know, to sign out of high school. And that's why I was kind of hoping that my son didn't get drafted real, real high. Because, you know, he's going to say, well, Dad, you signed out of high school. And I'm so glad that he didn't get, wasn't tempted, you know, by being a high-round draft choice, which I didn't feel that he was there yet. But what made my dad come around was the fact that, you know, I had to go to court against my dad with my mom and his lawyer and our lawyer, and he tried to nullify my contract, and they invoked the Jackie Coogan Child Prodigy Law, which the state of California was my trustee over my finances. As long as I was in school, I got an allotment. They gave me an allotment for to buy a car. And then when I was 21, that's when I started watching the stock market as a kid. I ended up being a broker later on, but I started watching the stock market because I was watching my little pennies, and they tripled. And so my dad really didn't come around. I'm the one that came around because, you know, it was my decision not to talk to, you know, my dad because I like I said, he's a mean old man. My money tripled and they invested in IBM and Standard Oil of California, which is now Chevron, and my money tripled. And all of a sudden, my dad wasn't as dumb as I thought he was. He was a lot smarter, a lot smarter than I was. So, And then I played my first game in Cal State Park against the Giants. And it was just something, like I said, it wasn't my dad. It was more me. Back then, when you signed out of high school, you couldn't play any other sports. You know, there was a Jim Thorpe law back then where if you were a pro in everything, in one sport, you were a pro in everything. So that's why when I look back, I didn't know the chance that I took and the major decision. Now, you know, you could sign pro baseball, you know, like John Elway, and go play pro football, you know. And so it was a strange, you know, turn of events. But like I said, I didn't want my dad to be right, and I didn't know the chance that I took by signing at such a young age.
You're one of these fascinating people that seems to be good at just about everything, because you dropped just in that answer like two or three things. Like, you know, I was investing then. I later became a stockbroker. People don't say I later became a broker and then just move on to something else. Like, how did you get to go down that direction?
Well, actually, my brother, you know, we had a business, and my brother had been battling manic depression and, depression and schizophrenia for a while. And, you know, I tried to take over at that time to, you know, to watch our investments, because they were going bad at the time. It was in the early to mid 80s, and they had the tax law changes, and, you know, we lost quite a bit of money at that time, which is, and I don't like asking people for money, which is really how I got into coaching. I didn't want to be a coach because I got skinny legs. I don't wear a whistle around my neck, and I have shorts on today, but I never wear shorts. And so I didn't want to be a coach. And again, I called my dad and I said, "Dad, what do? I was getting divorced myself, and I want to move back to Northern California out of L.A. And my dad told me to go to the mountaintop and just ask the Lord to direct me. And so my brother and I, the one that had the breakdown, and our daughters, we went to the mountaintop, Lake Arrowhead, which is above Riverside. And I was checking in and the Giants had wooed me to, Al Rosen to try to, get back into baseball. And the guy that recommended me was Bob Kennedy, who also recommended that the Braves back when I first signed, give me more money than, you know, my draft status slot that, you know, I was in. So Bob Kennedy advised Al Rosen that, hey, man, this guy would be a, you know, good coach and possibly a future manager. And so I was checking in the line at the Marriott, and there's a guy that tapped me on the shoulder, and it was Bob Lurie, the owner of the Giants. And I said, "What are you doing here?" He goes, "This is my first time here." I said, "Mine too." So I went to my room, called my dad immediately, and then said, "Dad, you think that's a sign?" And he said, "Son, look, if you don't think that's a sign, that means you don't need to. You didn't go up there for the right reason. Because the reason I was hoping that the sign would say no." And so that started my coaching career. And I said, "Hey, man, I give orders better than I take them. And if I can be the manager within 5 years, which I was almost 5 years to the day, and that's what started me in coaching for 5 years, and then I ended up being a manager."
So for you, how easy was it to get a hold of being the guy to give the orders? Is that, especially with that being something that you didn't, you know, start off wanting to do?
Well, it wasn't that hard because I was a dressed blue honor man in the Marines. I was captain of almost every team I was on. I was the oldest of five. My dad made me very responsible. And so I guess I was kind of used to giving orders, you know what I mean? And I don't know if the order is the right word, but at least carrying out orders. And so, yeah, I mean, it was very easy because, you know, my dad and mom raised me where no matter what, you try to do the right thing and tell the truth whenever you can without divulging everything to the players or the management. And so it was a pretty easy thing. Because, you know, like I love sports. I love being in charge and, you know, without being a dictator at the same time. You know, you just got to be yourself.
So for you, is like the honesty the most important part of it? Because, you know, your relationship with your players is probably one of the most positive things that people remember you as a manager and really point to a lot in terms of your effectiveness.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, but you can't tell them everything, but I don't lie to them. You know, it's like, "Hey, dude, you know, I got a job to do and a job to keep myself." And, you know, you just try to remember how hard this game really is. And the players make it look hard. And I remember one time, San Javier was my left fielder, and he lost the ball in the lights. And it was bases loaded and the bottom of the ninth, and we lost the game. And then I started to get kind of upset. And then I remember that I had missed that same ball in Montreal that Gary Carter hit about 20 years before, you know. So I just try to remember really how hard this game is to play, and just remember that, you know, everybody's capable of being a hero one day and being the GOAT the next day. And I think that helped me in my managing and coaching careers, the fact that, you know, I know what it's like to win the game in the ninth, and I know what it's like to lose the game in the ninth. And so you just got to try to remember that and convey that same thought to your players.
Well, what's the most difficult thing for you about managing that superstar class of player? Like Barry Bonds is on his own plane, but then he also had guys like Bryce Harper.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I had, you know, Jeff Kent, I had Ellis Burks. I mean, they're all different, you know, but like they're like thoroughbred horses. You know, they're like thoroughbred horses. You know, you can saddle them, but they don't really, you know, like to be ridden. And so it's a situation where, you know, you can bend the rules, but you can't break the rules. I mean, you know, like you can, I mean, you realize, because I learned that from Tom Lasorda, you know, and I learned that earlier in my career, you know, because I was a star player on the Dodgers, one of the star players on the Dodgers, and Tommy did give us, you know, a little bit different treatment. And I remember when I was on the Braves with Ralph Garr, I was out with Hank Aaron, I think Bob Tillman, Cleve Boyer, let's see, Rico Carty, all the stars of the Philippe Alou, all the stars on the team. And we had a curfew at like midnight. And so I, you know, they said, hey, Rook, they called me the kid. They said, hey, kid, you better go in because they got curfew. So I said, man, what about you guys? And they says, okay, we'll be on. So I get to the hotel about 2 minutes to 12, breathing hard. And this is Jim Busby was checking everybody in the hotel, you know, to see if they're in for curfew. Well, you know, my name is B. I'm at the top of the list. Hank Aaron, Alou, they're, you know, ahead of me. And Boyer's, like, right underneath me. And all these guys are checked off. You know, like, and Joe Torre, I said, man, how come all these guys, you know, they must know a shortcut. And so the next day, I said, Hank, man, how'd you guys get back so quick? They said, well, we didn't get back. And this is you'll see, son, the better player you are, then the more leniency you'll get. So I learned right then. That, you know, I mean, there are, you can bend the rules, just don't break them.
Now, we talked a couple times about Hank Aaron and this. You said Hank Aaron, you know, told your mom that he was going to take care of you. Do you remember the first time that you met Hank Aaron?
Oh, yeah. I was in Dodger Stadium, and I hadn't signed yet, and I was on the bus. I was on the bus sitting next to Hank Aaron, and I was working out. I had about 2 weeks to go. I had to make up my mind between going to Santa Clara, you know, which I didn't really want to go to. I wanted to go, you know, to a less academic school where I can have me a heck of a time. And there was, you know, there weren't many pretty girls there. And I was like, well, you know, I kind of like this. And I was on the bus, and he told me to sit next to him. And I sat next to him. I followed him around the clubhouse, followed him around in the outside, and I didn't have a number. And the kids were calling me no number. You know, I was in the outfield. I said, hey, no number, what's your name? And so that was the first time I met Hank. But, you know, we used to go over his house every day to eat as a September call-up. We used to go out to, in his room every day in spring training, Ralph Garr and myself. And, you know, I really pray that I didn't go to the Atlanta Braves, because I didn't want to go to the South, because I was 67, and that was anti-Vietnam, non-conformity to everything that there was. And I didn't, you know, they had riots, they had freedom marches and stuff, but you know, that was probably the best thing that happened to me, because thanks to Hank, you know, I got to meet, you know, a lot of the civic leaders of our time, especially in Atlanta, Ted Abernathy, Maynard Jackson, Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson. We just go over his house and eat, because then Hank was going for the record and everybody wanted to, you know, to be around Hank. So it was a wonderful thing, especially for a young kid like Ralph Garr and myself, to, you know, to be at the top of the food chain so very, very quickly.
Now, what's Hank like when we're not around? Because I feel like he's a guy we know a lot about, but we don't necessarily know very well if we don't know him personally.
Well, you know, he's a very strong man. He's a civic-minded man. You know, he was in the NAACP in Atlanta, the Urban League, and Hank was a guy who liked to laugh. And Ralph Garr and myself, our job was to make him laugh and to make him, to keep him loose. And he's a fun-loving guy, when it's time to have fun. But he's a very disciplined guy. Case in point, he believed in eating breakfast. I didn't believe in eating breakfast. I wanted to hang out late and then sleep late and then go to the ballpark, get something to go to the ballpark. Where Hank would put that sign outside your door that, please deliver breakfast here at 7:45. And they'd knock on my door, and I'm like, man, I didn't order any breakfast. And they said, well, it says right here, sir, you ordered breakfast. And it took me like 2 weeks to figure out who was putting that sign on my door. And so, Hank's a family man. He's the same now as he was before. And, people say, oh, yeah, and, he was bitter. He was this and that. But see, Hank wasn't bitter at all. Hank believed in equality. He believed in, the right thing. And, he loved kids. And, he spent, time not only with me, Latin kids, white kids, it didn't matter, who it was. Hank was a leader in the true sense of the word, because he was a fair man.
Well, what was it like for you to experience like 1973 and 1974 for the home run chase with Hank Aaron?
Well, it was, I batted behind him in the order. And, he would school me, and I didn't even know he was schooling me. He said, this guy's going to throw me a fastball low and away. I'm going to hit it over the left center field fence, or this guy's going to throw me a slider, and he's going to do this, he's going to do that. And, he wasn't bragging, or he was schooling me. And, but it wasn't a very pleasant time for Hank, because I'd see him walk in like Fred Sanford, and then he would it looked like he couldn't even walk, and then the game would start. Man, this guy could think away pain. He taught us how to play with pain, how not to complain. And but the hard part was the fact that, Hank, got a bunch of hate mail. And I could tell when he got some hate mail, because he would leave it on his chair or throw it on the floor. And then when he went in the training room, I'd pick it up and I'd see, some of the hate mail. I was surprised, but not really shocked. And like I said, there were a lot of people pulling against Hank Aaron. But that prepared me also, when I was with the Cubs. I got a whole bunch of hate mail with the Cubs, similar to what Hank got. And so, that made me more determined and more focused than, most of the things that happened in my life, especially adversely. There's nothing to make you stronger.
Well, just so everyone understands, when you're talking about with the Cubs, you mean like in the 21st century when you were managing them?
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, and one day I came in and there were these suits and sitting in my office. And it looked like, Men in Black or something. And they were sitting in my office, and I'm like, hey, man, what are you guys doing here? And they said, man, we understand that you're getting some hate mail, and you got some letters that, contain powder like it was anthrax. And they said, if you get any more of those, please call. Well, first they said, we're at the FBI. So I'm like, hey, man, how I know you with the FBI? So they show me their badges, and I guess you are in the FBI. and so I've been through, quite a bit in 21st century. I don't care what century it's in. I mean, there are people that still have different, prejudiceness against certain people. And it's not always, against blacks. It could be against whoever you don't like for whatever reason.
Well, did it surprise you when it happened then? Because I could understand not being surprised in 1974, but like 2004, 2005, I might have been a little bit more shocked.
No, it didn't shock me. I mean, it the initial shock, because you're opening, you're thinking it's fan mail, and then you're like, you're reading down. And then, I kept a lot of it, just like Hank did. And like I said, it sort of prepared you for to realize, what's kind of real in life. And, it's still here. But it depends on who you talk to, where you go. I think that young people are trying big time. I can tell, in the commercials. I can tell in the commercials where you see a lot more interracial people on the commercials, kids and things. But it's still here. But I think now, as much as racial discrimination, I think there's intellectual discrimination in as much as where you go to school. And there's definitely, which I felt that I was a victim of, was salary and age discrimination. Because it seems like they're trying to push most of the older guys out. And, you know, I love music. And, you know, most of the older dudes that I knew, John Lee Hooker and, you know, Santana and all these dudes, man, they welcomed playing with young players, and players welcomed, you know, learn from them. And I've always said that, you know, I think it's a thing as far as, you know, they give us, well, now that I'm a senior, before when I was a junior, you know, they would give us wisdom and, you know, knowledge, and we give them energy. And that's the same way that I feel about, you know, my son. So, you know, I just wish that baseball or sports period would not get rid of all the old guys, because they're, you know, they got something to, you know, something to you know, to learn from. And if you open your mind, open your heart, then, you know, you're going to be a much better person in the long run.
Well, what do you think the role of the manager in baseball is evolving into? Because it has changed a bit as to what it seems the teams are looking for.
Well, it's changed a lot. And, you know, in as much as, you know, the role of manager, I think, has diminished. Because I was told by one general manager, you know, anybody can coach or anybody can manage. Because, you know, a lot of guys are told who to play or what to do by the numbers. And see, it's still a people's game. You know, and if you can combine the numbers, which we always have, you know, we always use numbers. I always use as many numbers as I could. I'll take all the information and then use it with my own knowledge and feelings of the game, because I've been through almost every situation. Then, you know, that's a big reason for, you know, my success, is that we use numbers and use the personal side, too.
I think some people might be surprised by that, because I feel like there's a perception that you're a guy that was not one to embrace the numbers.
No. I use numbers all the time. I wrote down stats every day, like left-right matchups. I wrote down, like, you know, runners inherited. You know, I mean, we always use the numbers. You know, we always use who was a double play candidate, who was a strikeout candidate. I mean, it's hard to win as many games as we won and just go on your feelings. But I don't think you can go on the numbers either, because the number there, you know, there are no absolutes, Bomani, in anything. And to me, if you can be right 75-80% of the time, you're way ahead of the game. Now, when you get down to 50-50, then you might as well just go ahead and just flip a coin. You know what I mean? And that ain't going to get you too far, you know? So I don't know what the perception, though. I know the perception is, and I really don't care, because I know, you know, I know better. And so, you know, my staff knows better. My players know better. Sometimes, you know, the matchup isn't right, but you do certain things to try to get a player psychologically right, you know, for ensuing games. And sometimes you'll sacrifice one game to hopefully win 10 or 12. And so this is all part of management.
Hey, I mean, you guys heard, if you're looking for a big league manager, there's one guy that'd be a great candidate for you to hire, just like all kinds of other people are looking to make great hires at their offices. But it's hard to find qualified candidates. It takes too long, you get too many applicants, but ZipRecruiter makes it easy. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. What ZipRecruiter does is they send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but that's not all. They got powerful technology, because ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. With results like this, it's no wonder ZipRecruiter is the highest rated hiring site in America. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. You mentioned there when you're talking about that musicians and being into music, and that's actually one of the biggest reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I remember I read something that you had written about Jimi Hendrix, about how Hendrix had a control of the groove but still could do like almost the virtuoso stuff. And I was like, this is the most, like, the best encapsulation of Jimi Hendrix that I've seen. And I've been writing and reading this stuff for like 20 years, and I was like, wow, this is like amazing stuff. So like, when did you realize that music was a thing for you?
In my family, you know, my mother, I mean, she made us get up to Tobacco Road and Lou Rawls every day. that was my alarm clock, which I hated that song, but I ended up meeting and loving Lou. And then my dad, you know, he liked Miles Davis, which I didn't understand, but it sort of still attracted me. You know, he loved, you know, Thelonious Monk and Coltrane. And, you know, we always had music in our house. And then when I used to go to concerts all the time in San Francisco in the 60s, you know, Hendrix, Joplin, you know, James Brown, Ike and Tina Turner. And then when I went to the South, you know, it was more, you know, Johnny Taylor and you know, Gladys Knight and you know, the R&B scene. And then Orlando Cepeda, he was really into the Latin jazz. And, you know, he's the one actually that turned me on to Stanley Turrentine and stuff. And so I didn't understand it, but, you know, he was very influential in my music scene. He introduced me to Santana, which now, you know, I got a pretty good guitar collection. You know, Santana, B.B. King. I've seen B.B. King a couple times. Elvin Bishop is my fishing buddy. And then I got a Stones guitar. I have a, who else on my wall up there? Buddy Guy. You know, when I was in Chicago, I used to go by Buddy Guys all the time. And, I just got a new, right before Tom Petty died, I got a Tom Petty guitar. So, you know, I like all kind of music, because, you know, music really shouldn't have any color. And you see a bunch of different dudes that are playing with each other. I just saw somebody a couple days ago that was a lead guitar, you know, for Traffic. And so I just love music. I got music all the time in my office, in my car, guys. And then it really rounded me out when my son, you know, really got me into, you know, some rap music. And so, because, you know, they sometimes the words aren't that good, but the message is good, and the beat is good. So, you know, and my daughter, she's 38, so she turns me on to some music. My son turns me on to music, and then I, in turn, turn them on to some of my music.
Yeah, I was wondering if Darren had gotten you on to what some of these young boys are up to and what you thought of it.
Oh, yeah. Hey, it's cool, man. I mean, it's, I find myself rocking to it all the time, you know, bobbing my head to it. And so I was someplace, and let me see, who was performing? MOU or something? And my son told me, hey, man, you got to tape it. Then he showed all his buddies how hip his dad was. I didn't know who they were. And so, yeah, it's a nice thing. It's a nice thing. And music never dies. Like I said, I got music from all generations and all times.
Yeah, like Santana's one of my new fascinations now, because I got a record player and started doing the vinyl thing. And I got the first three Santana albums on vinyl. And those are the ones that are like, oh, this is completely unlocked now. Like, I thought this was cool. I misunderstood just how cold this was.
Well, and I had a buddy named Fred Ware. I think he is with CBS. He's since passed. But he used to give me all of these, you know, promotional albums. And I didn't know that the promotional albums were actually – you know, high, you know, definition recordings. And since I had a whole garage full of them, and I didn't know what I had really, and I was trying to clear my garage out, so I sold them to some record store in San Francisco for like quarter a piece.
Oh, man.
I know. So that's all. It's all good, man. So, like, I copied all of my CDs, which I have thousands of CDs, and so whatever mood that I'm in, then that's what I listen to, or the mood that I need to be in, because sometimes you need to be aggressive, sometimes you need to be mellow, sometimes you need to be, you know, in thought, and like today I was listening, and then I went to Cuba, and I got into the Cuban jazz scene, and I mean, that's a totally different scene. I mean, that's a heavy thing. And so Bronson Arroyo, one of my former players, he went to Cuba to see, you know, find his ancestry, and where his mom was born and dad, and he went over to Cuban dude's house, and he sent me a CD, which I'm listening to right now, you know, on my trip here. So, like I said, whatever mood that I need to be in, because sometimes you need to mellow down. Sometimes when you're angry, or sometimes when you're a little tired, you need to pick me up. And so, you know, that's what music does for me. And you know something? I took my son about 3 or 4 years ago. I take my daughter to a lot of concerts since they were young, and I took my son too, because I love Snoop Dogg. And so I took took my son to Snoop Dogg, and you know, he thought that was pretty cool. It wasn't too cool, all that, you know, all that weed they were smoking in there.
That's what I was about to say. That sounds like a smoky affair.
Well, hey, man, I still, you know, he was looking around at how people were acting, and Snoop came out. But it was, I mean, it was cool. You know, you can't hide these things from the kids, and, you know, you just got to expose it, and hopefully they make the right decision.
You know, bring it kind of back around to your son. One thing I was thinking about where you talked about, you know, being with the Braves and you and Rico Cardi and Ralph Garr and all those guys and having Hank Aaron as the resource. You know, a lot has been made of the change in demographics of baseball. Do you worry about if your son were to make the big leagues that that dynamic really isn't at play just because of the numbers of black baseball players?
Well, I think the dynamic is in play still, you know, because he's not a big, strong power hitter. You know, he has every tool going for him except you know, the power. And I told him, son, you just work on your skill, your power will come. And, you know, the only thing I worry about is the change of how they're teaching. You know, the launch angle of the ball is tough enough to hit to stay on the same plane of the ball. And, you know, we were taught, you know, strikeouts are taboo, you know, especially, I mean, I'm watching games, you know, they'll be bases loaded, nobody out. You'd be lucky to get one man. You know what I mean? And and so they sort of devalued the RBI, which I don't understand, because I know guys have to get on in front of you, but they've increased the walk. But, you know, it's, the game's gone base to base. So, like, you know, the RBI to me is even more important. There's only two ways to score runs, or three ways. So you got to drive them in, you got to score them, or you hit a home run and score them and drive them in at the same time. So I just worry about, you know, how unimportant the strikeout seems to be, or how valuable the strikeout seems to be, because everything's about stats. You know, we're teaching a team game, we're getting paid individually, but I think it's making guys kind of go more for themselves and away from going for the team.
Well, where do you stand on all the shifting that we're seeing now?
Well, you know, there are always shifts. You know, I remember Big Willie McCovey and Stargell hitting. I mean, the left field, the second baseman was playing way out in right field back then. He was fearful for his life, tell you the truth. And, you know, the one shift that I agree with is I notice when you put somebody up the middle, it's taking away a whole bunch of hits up the middle. You know what I mean? And that's the one shift that I really, really agree with. You know, maybe the lack of back control. They put the third baseman way over there at shortstop. And, you know, I mean, boy, I'd hate for them to shift on Tony Gwynn like that. He'd have hit every time. You know, so he might have hit 700. So, you know, it's something that I think is going to revert back some, you know, once speed and knowledge of how to play the game becomes more and more prevalent and more important.
All right. Now as you've had the time to enjoy and going around and watch your son play, how interested are you in getting back into managing?
Well, the way I look at it, I didn't get out of managing in the first place. And people ask me, hey, man, are you retired? And I said, no, I didn't retire. I was fired, and there's a difference. So, you know, I'm not in a hurry. I'm not in a hurry to do anything at this point. And, you know, if the right situation, again, it had to be the right, you know, situation for me to, you know, even think about it. So right now I'm just trying to enjoy my life and, you know, make a few bucks in the meantime and live happily ever after.
Well, hey, man, I know you said you're going to be on Long Island signing all those autographs, man. That's not a bad way to do it.
No, but it's for the kids. You know, I'm in Steel Sports. I'm on the advisory staff, and Gary Matthews, my main man, and I are going to go over there and, you know, to try to help the kids. Because, I mean, these are the guys that need help. You know, the kids need our help. Like I said, you know, they need our knowledge. And they need our wisdom, and, you know, we need their energy.
All right. Well, that is Dusty Baker, kind enough to join us from Cape Cod while he's watching his son play baseball. But, man, thank you so much, man. I really, really appreciate you spending the time with us.
I miss you, man, with those Cuban dudes down there in, down there in Florida, because that's one of the programs that I watch. And, hey, man, Pop kills me, man. What's his name?
Poppy, man. There he is. Poppy. Poppy's the star that everybody wants to meet.
Hey, man, he kills me, I swear. Because I was like, man, that don't make any sense, but it's still funny. But then when I think about it, a lot of it makes sense.
So, that's,
you know,
the trick.
He reminds me of my dad a lot.
That's right, the trick. Man. Once he starts making you think that he's making sense, he's got you.
I got you. Well, he got me sometimes.
Hey, there it is, man. You have a good one.
Hey, man, no problem.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on The Right Time. We try to do this a couple times a week. Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Of course, thanks to Dusty Baker for joining us, and thanks to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Remember, Tuesday's episode of The Right Time is The Right Time Book Club. We'll go through chapters 5-8 of Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger with my man Pablo Torre. Be sure to check us out on that. But remember to rate us, review us. 5 stars. You give us 4 stars, it's just going to look like you're a hater. Go ahead and give it all to us, and we will talk to you guys next week. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.